I wonder if we could develop this concept of summary of how this concept evolved in the design industry and how you're implementing it here at Walter Dorf and Teague Associates.
All right, as I was mentioning earlier, it's a well-established concept that people with communications background work with firms, design firms and architectural firms, in helping to spread the word about the projects they've done, their accomplishments, their to highlight designs or buildings or whatever design projects they've done. That's been fairly well established for a long time. I think that what is more recent and less common is the fact that in both architecture and in industrial design and all of the design disciplines, in fact, there's a far more active sense of marketing a firm's services than there used to be. Now, my argument is that, in fact, marketing a design firm's services is not really a new thing. It's just called by a new name. For example, Walter Dorf and Teague probably was one of, along with perhaps Raymond Lloyd, but Walter Dorf and Teague was a superb marketing man. I mean, no man wrote more widely, published more articles, spoke at more meetings, helped found more design associations. I mean, he simply was there all the time. And this is exactly what we really mean by marketing, in the sense of establishing the firm's leadership position by virtue of its showing that it's at the forefront in its thinking and so on. So that, you know, here 30 or 40 years later, we come out and we do these things as part of organized programs, and we call it marketing, but it's really just another side of the same thing, as I see it. Mm-hmm. But we do develop, obviously we do develop more marketing tools, more and marketing tools and simply marketing communications, like the corporate slideshow, which I worked on that one many years ago,
yeah.
Like the firm's brochures, like any of its of the literature it puts out.
Would you be involved in, say, if a company of this longevity, would you be involved in evolving a company history, a written company history?
Ed and I have talked about that in the past, and I think that it's always in the backs of our minds that this is something that we may very well do together one day. I think that another aspect of it is that there really has been not just a renaissance, but there has been the development of a whole discipline of studies called design history that didn't used to exist only a few years ago. I mean, architectural history has existed for practically ever, but no one has really looked at design from a historical point of view until fairly recently, and it's even truer in the sense that schools have not offered it as a discipline where you can get an advanced degree such as a PhD. Now it is. Now we get phone calls all the time, 20 or 30 a year from people at various institutions in England and Italy, wherever, and they want to come look at our archives, they want to come talk to us. And inevitably, one of these days, very soon, someone's going to propose writing a design history or a company history of Walter Dorf and Teague, and we're sort of sitting back expecting it. And I suppose we'd want to encourage whoever we think could do justice to the story, and that sort of thing. But no, I think that as we've been moving through this planning and development program for the last 2 years, we've really been putting a lot of our resources in that direction. And I think that probably when we've come out on the other side of it, we would want to give serious thought to the timing of when the company history gets done.
Have you attempted to preserve the company's archival records?
Certainly, the company's archival records have been very well preserved in the 12 or 13 years that I've worked with the company. When I became associated with it, I thought it was terrible that we hadn't saved every single design the firm had ever worked on. I mean, this would fill warehouses and would break the back of the company and so on. But I often felt that the materials we had were very inadequate. I learned later when we talked to archivists, design historians, or whoever, they come in and they look at our files and they are enormously impressed by what we have, and they say they've gone and talked to other firms which have nowhere near the records that we have. So I guess we haven't done as badly as we might have done, although on the other hand we haven't done perfectly ideally. But we have I think a very rich file of materials, certainly in two-dimensional form.
That's good. Has the artifacts of Mr. Teague's career preserved any meaningful
value? Yes, in the University of Syracuse.
That's the Teague collection?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
And the models, have they been?
The models, unfortunately, are almost non-existent as far as I know. Models, for example, from the 1939-40s World Fairs, things like that, we just don't have. If they're anywhere in someone's attic, I don't know about it.
A lot of them went to the client.
A lot of them went to the client. And whether the clients keep them, clients are usually not very good archivists at all. But one of the things that you could do so wonderfully and nobly would be with your resources and budgets and collection policies, I think that you could become very much that kind of center for a lot of these kinds of materials, because they're still being uncovered all the time. I mean, I go to antique fairs, Ed goes to antique fairs all over the East Coast, and one comes across Kodak cameras and other objects that this firm and other firms have been designing for these last 60 years. So they're still to be had, but I think time is is very critical in this
matter. We'd very much like to be a depository and an archives of industrial history, but it's not easy.
It's not easy.
As you know, people are not really ready sometimes to give up the design artifacts of their career. They want to hang on.
However, I think if they become increasingly aware that there's an institutional concern for these things and someone wants them somewhere, it will become like collections of painting and artworks and so on, that people will leave them in their, bequeath them in their will. Or
we certainly would want a large scale donation program, but it has to be sort of ad hoc in the sense, because we our contacts are limited to myself and my director, and so it becomes a long scale project. We hope to become just that. I would like, without it sounding mechanical, I would like to have on tape a listing of the firm's product design. Is that readily available?
Well, we have something which we call our distinguished client list.
That'd be marvelous.
I think we have a brochure.
I'd like to put that on tape. I have one of you put it on tape. Perhaps Nick could do that.
The distinguished client list?
Right.
It isn't all our clients, but it's what we call our distinguished
I think it would be helpful for people who listen to this tape to know precisely what products that you did participate in, did create, and what clients you had, what campaigns you had. So not just a distinguished client list, but a distinguished product list is what I'm
specifically.
If we could do that. Basically, that we could add perhaps in,
exactly.
Later today, but basically I'm interested in sort of a final statement from all of you as to how you feel, what place do you occupy in the pantheon of industrial design, and why? What accomplishments? Excitement of producing a product for a new world.
Well, I think it's a combination of all. I think that Mr. Tigg gave us the opportunity to work in a very exciting field. Over the period of the years, we have been successful in meeting the challenges of the period of the time, and we have moved ahead. In that fashion, I think that the success of any organization has to be the people that you surround yourself with, and if you can find the successful team and the successful ingredients to make that team move, then the company will not only succeed but go on to greater glory. I think the very fact that we've been able to attract to WDTA the right people that have the right attitudes, I think that's the most important, is the proper attitude about the type of work they're doing. As Frank has said, and I'll repeat him so many times in our meetings, that you have to breathe, and you have to sleep, and you have to eat design, and you have to sleep and eat and think about WDTA. It isn't a hobby. It is very serious work. We have to think also in terms how best we can serve our clients to make them look good. I know that in certain areas of design, the word, the bottom line, how it affects the bottom line is almost like a dirty word. But I think in all fairness, with the new people that we are now, contact, you see, the days of Mr. Tigg and Raymond Loewy and Dreyfus, they dealt only with the top echelon, the chairman of the board and chief executive officer, or the president, or the vice president in charge of this or that. And therefore, you were dealing with top decision managers. Today, in our world, we have to deal with the people who are the art directors, the managers, the brand managers. And they have a different, they're not the top decision makers, but they do influence it. They do influence what happens in the company. And I think in many, many cases, they are fearful for their own jobs. Therefore, they take a long time to make up their mind that your firm is the right firm to carry on the assignment. I think we've been able to instill in them the confidence that we can do the job and do it properly. and that we are thinking in the right direction, is that what's good for WDTA is good for the client. And I think in that way we've been successful. The future may bring other changes, but our main thrust is to do the proper job, do good design. I think we, in our statement, and the first statement we make is to enhance the good design. But also the fact is that to make the client look good and to affect the bottom line.
Are you opening up new avenues that you hadn't developed or heretofore, looking into new fields?
Yeah, I feel we are. I think what we're looking at now in ways that we can become more part of the team through helping them with their marketing.
Right.
And one time that was not the function of the designer, but I feel that now it is. We are helping them with their surveys of what they,
right,
how they look and what they should be looking for. I think these are all important steps. I mean, there's a field where I'm sure that one day the industrial designer will have psychologists on staff. Business management people in our staff. It's all, I think, in the future. But
maybe,
I think
maybe even veterinarians.
Yes. I think that one of the things that we're looking and talking about now is the focus groups. It's just a new buzzword.
Right.
But I think it's rather important that you do get these people together and talk about it and really come up with how we can be helping the client even more.
Ever done any restaurant designing?
Oh yes, oh yes. We did, in fact, some of the things we did for Boeing gets into that area. And we have an account that gives us an opportunity to do all those things as we are working on the Good Housekeeping test kitchens and their test labs.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, on one of our brochures, which I'll ask Ms. Gorn to give you, is an article on one of the labs that we did was on the beauty parlor business for Good Housekeeping. And that is an ongoing project, and we've had it now for close to 5 years, and we're working on all the areas of testing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was beauty parlor. I've had test kitchens. We did a series of test kitchens,
mm-hmm,
over the period of years for
General
Mills
and
Quaker Oats.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we did a restaurant for the Schaefer Pavilion.
At
the World's Fair, and we also, well, Dorwin Teague was with us when we did the Festival of Gas,
yes,
restaurant.
Yes, I was fascinated by that long-term relationship with the gas industry. Has that been retained, or is that
work
with him?
No,
that's
right, with him. Yeah, when he left the organization.
What do you see in terms of expansion in the future? Do you see any changes in approaches, standard approaches to design? Do you see the use of another material? Will there be more emphasis on plastic, or will there be different fabrics or different colors? Are we moving into a new era of
confusion?
where colors and plastics, mm-hmm, and precious metals are becoming almost a cliche. Are you disturbed by some of the things you see around you in design?
Well, I'm not particularly disturbed by, I'm disturbed by some of the forms of it takes, but not by the use of the material. Some, there is some misuse of material, but I think in the long run, this is one of the revolutionary periods that we're going through, and it will eventually become evolutionary after the dust settles and they begin to right now composite materials are the
yes.
greatest thing in the world, but they have curing problems. Time is a problem in composite materials. You can't put it into a molding machine and shoot it and have it come out practically ready to use, except for its heat, how hot it is to handle.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I can't. I think, as I said before, that each problem will require a resolution that is specifically geared to solve that problem, and the materials that will be dictated for use will be, to a great extent, dictated by economics and the number and the makeup of the market that they have to reach. The overriding factor in all of what you're asking, however, is the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
How big is the marketplace versus how big is the investment to get into the marketplace, and how quick can we get into the marketplace, and how fast can we get out after Joe Blow decides to get into it with us?
With your relationship with Boeing, are you interested in space at all?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
The company is me.
Yeah, that was, I mean,
I'm,
you
I'm,
you and
the company is we've always had a difficult time selling our services to the aerospace division.
Why is that?
After, I have no idea. Well, they look upon us as aesthetic, feel as an aesthetic balderdash.
Mm-hmm.
But I think eventually we're going to get involved in the space program out there, and it will probably pay off.
You've been product designer for years, why not extrapolate to the space industry?
It will work. We just have to prove ourselves, and I think we're doing something now for one of the programs that may somehow get us involved. And I think we're going in through the back door, because working for the Boeing Military Aircraft Division, who has been is a responsible cognizant company for manufacturing the interior of Air Force One, will give us an opportunity to prove our worth in a practical way rather than in an aesthetic way to the pure engineering, military engineering mind that may get us into the aerospace effort, conceivably.
What are your feelings on that line? Are you interested in expanding the firm into aerospace?
Very definitely. I think it would be, well, first of all, I think it would be very exciting for our designers.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the future which we're talking about, something for the future. We are going to do Air Force One. We're now, by the way, the contract is on its way to us, and we should have it.
In the mail.
We should have it in the mail by Monday morning. We've checked with them, and which makes us all very happy. But just that alone is exciting, and it is working with the people who are responsible for that phase of the Boeing work. But I also think it's a program that's going to be vital to the country even more.
It seems to be a natural extension of your pioneering work in interiors that you would do. You would become specialists in making the environment within space vehicles and space colonies user friendly.
Yeah.
Yes, I think we know probably. I think we, putting it all together, we probably know more about it than most people.
Well, yes, but we haven't been able to prove it. That's our problem. We have a certain naive attitude about that kind of thing, and we have to market ourselves in that area. We haven't been able to prove it. We haven't had enough market. We haven't had enough market hoopla to make it. We don't have the man with the mystique that can sit at the end of a table and just get people to sit and listen to him.
Mm-hmm. It seemed to me that that your area would be very useful.
Obviously, I mean, the whole point of marketing communications is to help a company position itself to get where it wants to go. Reposition it in an existing market, of course, mm-hmm. very much so.
And so some of your efforts obviously will be directed in this.
Of course. As I say, we're developing a marketing plan right this minute. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've had them in the past, but we think that we're due for one because so many things have come together about the firm's 60th anniversary. Mm-hmm. As Frank's saying, this is a very transitional time, and there's a great deal of uncertainty, but we think it's the time to really focus in to what will be the next 5 or 10 years, and it's mm-hmm. just a fine time for us as a firm where we are now mm-hmm. to do it. And I think all of these things will become much clearer in about even in the next 2 or 3 months mm-hmm. when we talk about it, but I think that we should be putting very specific marketing efforts and positioning the firm for these areas that we're interested in. Mm-hmm. Yes. Indeed.
You see, I think that one of our statements for the division, and one which we have adopted mission statement, says that it continuously perceives needs to meet the challenges of the future.
Right.
And that means all challenges of the future. We see great things happening in the medical field, and we are now working with members at John Hopkins on helping off the handicapped, and especially handicapped children and the elderly. There's a whole field out there that very little has been done. Now, this is not going to put money in WDTA's bank account, but we still feel it is a very vital thing that we should be involved in. And I feel the same way about the aerospace. I mean, it is a challenge for the future, and I think we should try to meet them. And that's one of the things we will do.
You're becoming a public service firm as well as a corporate service firm.
Yeah,
service firm.
Well, one of the things we said in there is to make enough money to sustain continuity and goals, and that has to be considered too. But I think the thing that we really want to do is to meet those challenges that are coming for not only WDTA, but I think everyone in the design field. I think in the next 2 years, the Association for Design Firms is going to stress the one thing that has been lacking that most industrial designers haven't thought about, is to inform the publics and their clients of the value of design. It's been sorely neglected, and we realize it now that the way we have there is responsibility by the designer to let the publics know about what we do. Because whatever we do, and the designer has forgotten it, is that everything we do not only touches that magical financial statement, the bottom line of a company, but affects very definitely and very profoundly the lives of everybody who uses that product, but also the lives of the people who work for the company in which we design for. We've forgotten that, and we have to remind the publics and keep reminding ourselves that it is that responsibility. Design has impact, and it has a responsibility. And what we're going to try to do is to awaken that in the minds of the publics. We do have that responsibility.
In terms of public responsibility and the burgeoning government relations for safety, has there been any problems within the design industry over increased awareness of a safe product? Has there been any sort of overview of the industry, perhaps a organization that a self-policing, self-regulating organization?
No, but I think if you look at Britain and what they have accomplished in that field, Nick and I were privileged to be in London and to hear the, forget what his title was, somebody or other.
Well, Sir Terence Conran established the Boiler House in London, but then the minister, director of every major ministry office in government, the Minister of Education, Minister of Industry, I can't remember them all, but they were all at this grand opening we went to, Ed and I, about 4 or 5 years ago, and I can't remember who spoke.
Neither can I. But also, I think, at the Design Council, the meeting we went to at the Design Council.
That's right, there is a Design Council.
Yeah, who passes on the product and on the design of the product. And we were privileged to see those items and to listen to the report of how this group looks at the products and something like our good housekeeping.
Mm-hmm.
Seal of approval on them, and it doesn't come easy. Remember, he said it. A lot of the products are submitted, but all the views are chosen.
But there's no such organization like that in the United States.
No. I think that, very frankly, some of the groups, and I've talked about this at the meetings, I think that such as the IDSA and our organization, the Design for Association of Design, should start something like that.
Mm-hmm. It's the kind of thing that might come out of the National Endowment for the Arts,
right? Yes,
something
sir.
Like that as well. Listen, I don't mean to, but I have to eat something, right?
I'm fascinated by this, that the British, of course, have a much smaller economy, a much smaller ethos there, but they have come up with a self-regulating mechanism that might well be applied to this. The United States design industry.
Maybe Nick is more familiar with or knows more about. They actually approve or disapprove.
Well, I think I don't know what the formal procedures or mechanisms are, but they do have a design center. It can sponsor. Educational and cultural things, but it also is a display of design items and design objects or fabrics or whatever, and there is obviously a board of directors or whoever that selects those items that are exhibited.
I believe what you're talking about, if I remember fringes of it. This group really passes on the overall value of the design as a design, and
exactly.
It takes into account the safety characteristics as well. But the seal is a seal of good design.
Yes, right, yeah.
And if you buy a product, it has that little seal on it or whatever it is, and it's been the Design Council, the British Her Majesty's mark, is on
it. That's right.
We've never in our largely egalitarian society, we've never really had there's never been any pressure or there's been a resistance to a sort of a regulation at this time. This industry has probably sort of grown up in a sort of unregulated form. In other words, most designers say, I don't need to be regulated. I turn out a good product and my client is satisfied. That's it. But it seems to me that there's been no sort of seal of approval. They've all been highly informed.
No, they haven't. The seal of approval is in the form of more or less, I think, the annual design reviews that are done by some magazines which are highly politically motivated and
various associations,
and
I mean, it comes from various sources.
Associations.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the dangers in that is like the being a judge of a design, making a design judgment, you never know what the ramifications were or what the specifications were that this poor designer had to use,
right.
What his controls were that he had to use to solve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
So you either give him a glorious review because he didn't have any problems, they just said, here, do something nice,
uh-huh.
Or they said, here, do something nice, but you can't go beyond these dimensions, and you can't round the corners because it'd be too costly on the tools, and you can't do this, and you can't do that, and you can't do the other thing. So he puts a chrome bead on it and gets a bad mark for being a chromist. You see what I'm talking about?
Right.
So these judgments are very difficult. Unless you go deeply enough into the background of each one of these assignments, and I think that's what the British Design Council does.
I think that they probably have a very, you know, strictly formalized checklist of, you know, of things to look for and to judge by. But I mean, I've sat on design juries in New York, and one was, I remember very well, was an interior design thing, and I mean the presentations, you know, had to be very elaborate of photography and text, and, you know, writing out the program and everything else, and all of these jurors, no one read anything. I mean, they would just go there and say that one and that one and that one.
It's an emotional reaction.
And it was an emotional reaction, and I got in trouble because I tried reading the things, and they wanted to move on. So I was never invited back to judge again. but it is very discouraging that these things are. And of course, you know, the juries are selected ad hoc, as it were. They change every year. It's not a logical, rational, sensible procedure. I mean, there are obviously some that are very, very good. By the quality, the Progressive Architecture Awards, I think,
mm-hmm.
are very good.
Yeah.
For what they do.
Mm-hmm.
What they do.
That's fascinating. So you do have this syndrome of designing for the award jury.
Absolutely.
And it sometimes gets out of hand.
Yeah.
And the practical aspects of design, mated with the forward look of the futurist designer. Supposing someone came to you and said, look, I want all seats. I want you to consider that all airline seats will now be horizontal. most comfortable position the passenger can be in. And we're going to have to stack them. What would you think?
We tried that.
Did you really?
Yeah.
How long ago?
A long time ago. What would the reaction be?
What would your reaction be?
Reaction.
Or what would your...
Well, first of all, our reaction would be to understand the motivation and then to understand the marketing characteristics that, or the marketing objectives that they wanted to achieve, which is slightly different than the motivation. And thirdly, we would probably approach the problem in a realistic way. By indicating that you can't get this thing any higher than 36 inches off the ground. Because if you expect to fill the airplane up to here, these people are not going to be able to get down to the floor, and so forth and so on. And or we may have to have a thing that does something like these little jewelry trays.
There you are.
Stopping at a proper distance from the floor so that you can get off and stand up and go wherever you want to go. And ask them how they expected to feed the passengers. And we'd have to go through that entire range of thinking and then make some visuals that demonstrated the possible ways that it could be achieved.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe make a model or two.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, if space travel becomes the norm, as it threatens to be in the next century, there would have to be some very basic revisions in thinking about accommodation of passengers and the methods of cooling, feeding, heating, and all of these would have to be attacked on a sort of a broad basis. So you're going to have to add to the staff some futurists and some scientists.
Yes,
too.
You see, we had an interesting, I want to relate that to, we would, there's a lot of data gathered on that kind of thing now. That I'm sure Boeing would have available for us. But there are some peculiar things that go through people's minds. When we were on the SST assignment back in 1965,
what was that again?
When we were doing the SST.
What was the SST?
Supersonic
transport
for Boeing.
Yeah.
They weren't building the commercial. It was the competition to build the commercial vehicle.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
The flight regime was 120 minutes to Paris, and the airlines wanted to serve a full-fledged meal, as they do today, in 120 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 120 minutes, it took 40 minutes to get to level flight. 40 minutes of level flight time and 40 minutes to approach flight.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, you only have 40 minutes to serve one of these super, and they were talking about extremely elaborate meals.
Mm-hmm.
See, and what I was trying to do at the time was to try, I was trying to get the airlines to think in terms of rethinking their method of food service, the methodology for their food service. In order to save weight, in order to improve the speed of for service, just pre-packaging a lot of this stuff so that you didn't have to go through all that, and getting in with a food packaging company like Campbell's or Beatrice or you name it.
Yeah.
These are the problems.
Brought you into a whole new field.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, as you know, the Supersonic was killed, but our airplane was flying from New York to Paris in 120 minutes, and that was just not enough time for level flight to feed 250 passengers, and we're carrying 250 passengers. You got to feed 250 passengers.
In 40 minutes.
It just wasn't going to work.
How was it reconciled?
We just put galleys in the damn airplane. There's a limit. You have to respond to the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a time scale involved. The airlines we'll solve the problem. Just give us the space, and this is what the space is. But that was all wrong in my mentality. It was just the wrong approach to the problem in the long run. And I let everybody that I could know about it. But you get practical after a while, and you just do what they want.
Did Boeing lose out on the SST? Competition?
No, they won the competition, but it was canceled because of all of the concern of the environmentalists that is going to develop this shield in the atmosphere to heat up the earth.
So the British and French concern went ahead, though. And,
Yes, of course. We financed it, too, but that's okay.
is Boeing ever going to get back into the supersonic?
Eventually, they may. They may.
Who's doing the B-1?
B-1?
Military?
Rockwell, I think.
Rockwell's doing
it. I think Rockwell is doing the B-1. But that's a different kind of a regime. That's a different requirement. The frequency is not there unless it's an emergency condition. The frequency of commercial flights was quite different, and they were flying airplanes at supersonic speed over certain areas and taking. Surveys on reaction of populations from the sonic booms.
Right.
There was a whole raft of reasons why we should not build the SST at that time. The illustrious senator from Wisconsin was one of the leaders in killing Proxmire.
Yeah.
He said it curdled the milk of the cows in Wisconsin, the cheese.
Also, Arthur Godfrey,
who said
it would curdle Achilles and Achilles in the stream and someplace.
Arthur Godfrey was also.
Read the movie Redford.
So there were a lot of people that didn't, there was pressure to cut it.
Well, the success of the Concorde.
And the cost of the airplanes was another thing.
Was it? Mm-hmm. Enormous. Increased costs.
So the British and French airplanes are terribly costly, but they have been sponsored by the government. And the British airlines at the time, and I think still is, a government-owned facility.
Yeah.
Air France is also a government-owned airline, so how do you beat the odds on a thing like that?
It seemed at this juncture that it would be important for us to have a listing of the key design commissions that Walter Darwin Teague Associates has had over the last 40, 50, 60 years of its existence. Mr. Nicholas
Politis,
who is a consultant to the company in communications, has graciously agreed to list the important commissions over the history of the company, and to, whenever possible, to indicate what type of services were utilized, and if you can, the product that ensued from that.
Yes.
As much as you can, yes.
Okay, for American Machine and Foundry, or AMF Incorporated, we've done packaging, bowling equipment, a monorail at the New York World's Fair in 1964 and 65. We've done airline interiors for Air Cal, which is Air California, Air Atlanta, and Air Canada. For the American Can Company, we've done cheese packaging, a logo design for American Express Company. For the American Gas Association, we did a gas pavilion at the New York World's Fair 64 and 65, and we did in the 1950s an all-gas appliance wall for a model kitchen. For American Standard, we've done bathroom fixtures. For American Telephone and Telegraph, exhibit design. For Anderson Clayton and Company, packaging for the soft margarine product. We've done systems engineering for Applied Physics Laboratory at the Johns Hopkins University. Interiors for the Bank of Bermuda. The Boeing Company, a very large client, we've done airplane interiors for all the jet planes produced by that, commercial jet planes produced by that company. We've done facilities design. We've done product development. For the Boeing Vertol Company, we've done helicopter interiors. For Borden Incorporated, we've done packaging. For the Carver Boat Corporation, we've recently designed a 42-foot cabin cruiser interior. For Cathay Pacific Airways Limited, we've done airplane interiors, corporate identity, passenger amenities, and ticket offices. For Chemical Bank, we've done bank interiors. For Collins and Aikman Corporation, fabric design. For Dracket Company, packaging. For A.B. Dick Company, we've done product design and graphics. For Fairchild Stratus, we've done airplane seating. For Fieldcrest Mills, we've done blanket control design. For C.B. Fleet Company, we've done packaging and graphics. For Frito-Lay, packaging. General Electric Company, both packaging and product design. General Foods Corporation, we've designed test kitchens. The Good Housekeeping Institute, we've done an interior redesign of their facilities. For Guest Quarters, which is a chain of hotels, we've done signage. For Gulf Air, an airline in the Middle East. We've done interiors and corporate identity. For the Gulf Oil Corporation, we've done gas stations, corporate identity, and packaging. For Honeywell Incorporated, we've done controls design. For IBM, graphics. For the Jepson Burns Corporation, airplane seating. For SC Johnson & Son, we've done packaging. For the Kenworth Truck Company, we've designed vehicle interiors. For Kidder Peabody & Company, we've designed an annual report. For LTV Corporation, we designed a ground transportation system called AirTrans at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, and also exhibits. For Eli Lilly & Company, we designed a building complex in Indiana. For Litton Industries, a microwave oven. For Magnet Design, furniture design. For Merbustoff Langenthal, we've done corporate identity. For More Business Forms, we've done graphics and product design. For NetExpress, we've done a laser copier, that's product design. For the New York City Transit Authority, we've done quality assurance work. For Knoxell Corporation, we've done packaging and graphics. For Packard Inc., we've done interiors. For Pan American World Airways, we did an entire fleet modernization program of airline interiors, corporate identity, ticket offices, signage. For People's National Bank of Washington, we've done interior design. For Piedmont Aviation, we've done airline interiors. For Polaroid Corporation, we've designed cameras. The Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, we've conducted seminars and quality control in transportation and exhibit work. For Procter & Gamble, we've done very extensive packaging design. For the Purolator the Courier Corporation, we've done corporate identity. For Qantas Airways Limited, we've done airplane interiors and ticket offices. For the Seattle First National Bank, we've done interior design. For the Sherwin-Williams Company, we've done packaging. For Shorts Brothers Limited, the Belfast, Northern Ireland airframe manufacturer, we've done airplane interiors and corporate identity. We've done both product and graphic design for the Simpson Paper Company and the Simpson Timber Company. For the Smithsonian Institution, in fact, at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., we've done an exhibit design. For Steinway & Sons, we've done a piano design. For Timex Group Limited, we've done watch designs. For Trans World Airlines Incorporated, we've done interiors and corporate identity. For the United States government, we've long designed for many of the agencies of the U.S. government. For the Air Force Academy, for example, we did the interiors of the Air Force Academy, and we've done product development. For the Atomic Energy Commission, we've done exhibits. For the U.S. Coast Guard, we've done human engineering. For the Department of Agriculture, we've done exhibits. Department of the Army, we've done ammunition packaging. Department of Commerce, we've done exhibits. For the Department of the Navy, we've done systems engineering. For the Department of Transportation, we've done an advanced concept train. For the Federal Prison System and Unicor, we've done graphics and packaging design, and product design, excuse me. For the U.S. Information Agency, exhibits, and now getting out of our non-government work, for Webcor Electronics, we've done electronic products. For the Winchester Group of Olin Corporation, we've done ammunition packaging and corporate identity. And at Yale University, we've conducted a seminar course for undergraduates in industrial design. That's it.
Have you really? That's incredible. Well, it occurs to me, Nick, that this is an incredible record of
Well, we've been around for 60 years, so we've had plenty of time.
I'm just amazed at the really complex the breadth and the depth and the complexity of the design services you offer to the nation's and the world's industry. Really, your futures would seem to be unlimited.
Well, I think that the future of industrial design is very much the future of industry and institutions and you know, very largely tied up with the economic future and the educational future and of our entire country.
Well, you're in a very necessary industry, and your work would be to expand their horizons.
I think if you look back at the history of Walter Dorr and Teague Associates since its founding, obviously Teague himself was one of the very great entrepreneurs in this company. And throughout its whole history, I think its success has been very much based on a series of entrepreneurial moves or thrusts. For example, the first 10 or 15 years of Teague's life, it was throughout all of industry and the world's fairs and the communications of what design was and the holding out of hope for the future to the betterment of mankind and the advancement of material progress and all of these things. I think that in the 40s, we made a very big thrust in both engineering work and in aircraft work, and we were in very much at the ground floor of the development of the commercial aircraft building. In the 50s, it was in packaging, it was in other areas, and I think that in a way, what we want to help the company expand on is to help it position itself to make these new entrepreneurial thrusts into the future, and that all of these things that that we can do through through marketing, through communications, should really lay the groundwork for the company to take advantage of and maximize these kinds of opportunities.
Good. And I think you've been successful in the last few years. Your list of contracts and commissions have expanded greatly in the last 10 years.
Well, we always when we hear that said, we smile and we keep our fingers crossed.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.